Hello again and welcome to I've Got a Beatles podcast, and Dave is here with you today. I'm very excited to be interviewing Tim Riley, who is an author and professor. He's associate professor of journalism at Emerson College, as well as the author of many books, including related to the Beatles, specifically Lennon, The Man, The Myth, The Music, The Definitive Life, as well as Tell Me Why, The Beatles Album by Album, Song by Song, The 60s and After. And the subject of today's interview will revolve around his new collaborative effort with Walt Everett, who's a professor at the University of Michigan, music theorist. They collaborated on a new Beatles textbook called What Goes On, The Beatles, Their Music, and Their Time. So welcome to the program, Tim, and thanks for speaking with me today.
Oh, thanks. My pleasure. Great to be here.
I'm always curious with Beatle authors, and I mean, you've been writing about the Beatles for a very long time, because when was the publication date of Tell Me Why? It was sometime in the late 80s?
1988.
Yeah, 1988. And something I didn't know about you that I remember asking, and I think you were kind of coy about it, but I wanted to know about your musical background, which is quite extensive, actually, and how, out of a classical training, how did you get into the Beatles?
I was born in 1960, so I'm actually a little bit behind the curve. My first album was Abbey Road. And in the summer of 1970, I got the Let It Be album, and I went to see Let It Be in the theaters. So I was 10 years old. And I had a very strange obsession with that movie as a kid. I was very, very, I don't know. There was something about that movie that really lit me up. We had a local theater a half mile from where we lived, and every Saturday and Sunday there was a $1 matinee, and you could go see Hard Day's Night and Yellow Submarine and Let It Be for $1.
Wow, what a deal.
Every single weekend, yeah. And you know, the received idea about Let It Be is that it's, you know, they're rolling cameras in January of 1969, and the Beatles are sort of breaking up. And while that's true, that's just one layer of the movie. And the other layer of the movie is that they really were self-consciously trying to film themselves in rehearsal and trying to, you know, give the audience a sort of peek back doors at how their songs take shape and how their ensemble comes together and how the arrangements come together. And I remember as a young musician, though, I just started taking piano lessons that same year. And I remember being very excited that the most famous band in the world was going to let us see how bad they sounded before they sounded great, you know?
Yeah.
For a young musician, that was really, really very dramatic that the Beatles were actually saying, look, you know, we do sound kind of rough a lot of the time. Like it takes a lot of sounding bad before we get to sounding good. I remember that being a very profound lesson as a young musician. And it really inspired me. You know, it really made me think, well, if I just keep at it, you know, maybe I'll be okay. And I did study piano for a long, long time. And I did 2 degrees in piano, my undergraduate degree at Oberlin, where I actually did a double degree, which was a 5-year program. So I did piano and English. And then I went on and got my master's in piano performance at Eastman, because that's where all the money was in the early 80s. You could make a ton of money if you were a piano player. I was good at it, and I really loved the repertoire. I loved going and taking piano lessons every week, and I loved conquering a lot of those pieces that I was learning and doing the recital stuff. And I really just had no clue what I wanted to do. And I was on sort of a track to stay and get a PhD in piano when I got a book contract. So as I was going to music school, I developed this course on the Beatles. And I was one of these characters who was always, like, you know, very enchanted by rock and roll and listening to lots of rock and roll. And the more I studied piano, the more I got to learn the classical literature. And I fell in love with both. And people thought I was kind of an oddball because I really did like both a lot. But I was always perplexed that people thought me strange, because I thought, well, why can't you have both?
Right.
it just didn't seem to me like there ought to be any kind of contradiction there. I really felt like, well, you know, just because you like Beethoven, I mean, why should that mean that you don't want to listen to Led Zeppelin? I mean, to me, it was like a no-brainer. Like, well, yeah, give me both. Give it all to me, you know. And so that's sort of the simple version of the story. And when I got the book contract, then it was very clear. It was like a thunderbolt moment for me. That's when I decided to be a critic.
And that leads us to Tell Me Why, which was your first book, I believe.
That's right.
Okay. And it's what I liked about it, and I still do, and I like books like this, because you have a Bob Dylan one that's also similar. The album by album, song by song discussion about a particular take on songs. And sometimes they're popular opinions, sometimes they're not. You know, I think of Ian MacDonald's Revolution in the Head, which has some pretty unpopular opinions, I'd say, at least among most Beatle fans, that maybe While My Guitar Gently Weeps isn't such a good song, or things like that. But what was kind of the impetus for writing Tell Me Why, and what was your approach to critiquing songs, you know, all the entire Beatle catalog like that?
Well, first of all, I was young and naive, so I really just thought, well, I have this idea, and I'll just plow ahead. In order to put the course together, I had read, you know, I read all the major books. And when I put the syllabus together for the course, I started figuring out what my blank spots were. So I read all those books and I looked at all the documentaries that I could find. And, you know, it was very clear to me that most of the material out there was biographical.
Right.
And I was a person who I was interested in the biographies, but I was much more interested in what made the music tick and why the mechanics of the music were so beautifully wrought, and how they seemed to have some real interesting engineering going on behind the magic. And so I knew I wanted to do a musical biography. That is, I wanted to write the story of the Beatles and their development through music, not their development through the lives they were living, but how their early songs actually seemed to kind of be the foundation and the genesis for their later songs. And that if you got to know the whole catalog, you sort of appreciated the context of any given song better. Now, when I was coming of age, it was a big moment for me realizing that the American albums that we had gotten were different than the British albums.
Right. You said 1988. And, so that was after a year after the British ones came out.
Right.
CDs.
So once they jumped to CD, they fixed all that. But, you know, before that, you had to be a certain stripe of Beatle collector to really be into the British song sequences. But my argument is that if you understand the way the Beatles are laying out those records from the very beginning, they make a lot more sense. And there's certain patterns that emerge in these song sequences on the British editions that you just don't get on the American editions. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time just puzzling over why certain critics are really still really fond of like the American versions of certain records when they're just completely cockeyed.
Yep.
They're just like, they're not, there's no thought behind them. There's no, you know, they're really are products of a record company trying to squeeze more money out of the same amount of material.
Well, and so, in fact, just to jump in for a second, in fact, Dave Dexter, the producer some producer or engineer for the American Capitol albums, all of his archives are at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, where I teach. And so I've gone in and listened and read some of what he's said, and it was clearly about the money. He said, I don't like this music. This is just, it's not going to last. It's just, I'm a jazz guy, but we're going to make money off this. And then they kind of did their own mixes and everything else. So,
right.
Yeah. Very strange compared to the actual, what the Beatles did.
Right. Well, and it's very hard to teach students now. It's the hardest thing about teaching the Beatles to my Emerson students is convincing them that really nobody took it seriously back then.
Yeah.
And the Beatles were, you know, a big piece of the idea that rock and roll was something that could be thoughtful and adult oriented and could be considered aesthetically substantial. And mm-hmm. it was just not thought of that way as it was happening. That was part of the thrill of it all, was that you could be collecting it and understanding that these were great works of art you were getting. And they were also popular, and that nobody seemed to understand that they were great works of art.
Right. How do you feel like your book holds up today? Have you changed your opinions on some of the reviews that you gave back in 1988?
I have, and it's been very interesting. I never in a million years thought I would write three books on the band. But I have changed my mind on a lot of different things. And I don't know, I haven't picked up Tell Me Why in a long, long time, but I do know that I've changed my mind about Pepper a lot. And when I wrote about Pepper for the John Lennon book, I really reprocessed my whole conception of the record. I used to think it was kind of overrated.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of noise you have to cut through when you're listening to that record. And I think I was probably brought up in an era, and that was people that were bashing it over our heads that this is the greatest rock and roll album, et cetera. And, but I do, you know, I do think that it's not that it's a bad interpretation, but I've really changed my mind. I really think it's like pretty much a great piece of art, like as great as anything else they do. And, the one exception I would say would be I think the George song is weaker than all three of the George songs on Revolver.
Interesting.
But even so, I've even grown to like that song more than I used to. So this is what happens over time. Your tastes do go through these. They are fluid.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of bands I've changed my mind about. There's songs I've changed my mind about. And Pepper is a good example of that.
And that's, again, maybe a product of the time, too, because I remember the 1987, I had just started subscribing to Rolling Stone, and I think that was, it was the 20th anniversary, and they had wasn't it like a greatest albums of all time or something, and that was number one, and
oh, sure.
It was just everywhere. So you write elsewhere about nostalgia, or you've talked about books that talk about nostalgia and looking back, and I feel like we're in kind of a different age now where, in a way, I feel like we're kind of being controlled or steered to believe something with all these big editions and big deluxe sets. And I don't know if that's necessarily a good or bad thing.
I think it cuts both ways. I mean, I think the Beatles have gotten very savvy about how to market themselves 50 years on. You know, if anybody deserves to learn how to market themselves and do better than they did the first time, I think it's the Beatles.
Yes. Yeah.
On the other hand, it is a kind of a distortion of what was originally, you know, a very freewheeling, a very messy process, and there was a kind of chaos and excitement around it. It was totally unpredictable. It was totally suspenseful. I think in some ways, hearing those records for the first time in sequence must have been just absolutely thrilling. I can't imagine what that was like.
Yeah.
And it must have been very profound. And so the people who went through it as part of their coming of age story, to sort of come of age alongside the Beatles, I think that was probably a very profound experience and, you know, something that people hold very dear. And I did it a little bit backwards. But even I have my attachments to certain moments that happened as they happened. And they're, you know, they are kind of precious. And it's hard to convey that to the younger generation without sounding like an old sap.
Well, we'll get to that when we talk about the textbook, because I think that'll definitely come into play there. And because as you're trying to reach a student generation taking classes on the Beatles, which now exist everywhere. But before we get to that, the next step, as you mentioned in your Beatle writing, was your big Lennon book, which was in 2011. Right. And I'm curious, first of all, why, you know, John Lennon, of all people, has a lot of big biographies about him, and he's a challenging subject to tackle. So what spurred that interest, and what did it teach you about John that you know, I'm sure a lot of things, but pick something or a couple things that it taught you that you learned after writing about him.
Yeah. So I contracted for that book in 2003, and I had been out of work for a while. I needed a big paycheck. I needed to develop a big project. So there was that. But it was also my observation that at that point he had two major biographies. He had Albert Goldman, which is probably the most notorious and the worst. And he also had Ray Coleman, which is very sympathetic and uses Cynthia as a primary source. And also weak in certain ways. And it was my observation that, A, he was due for a new major biography at that point. And also, as I was working on it, I had gone to London to teach a Beatle course for a friend. And I said to one of the Beatle guys over there, who's a Beatle tour guide, so as I'm working on that book, two other books come out. So the Bob Spitz biography of the band comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to this Beatle expert over there, I said, "So how did you like the Bob Spitz book?" And he looked at me like I was from Mars. Like, why would I ever ask him that? And he said to me, well, in this very British condescending way, he said, "Well, it certainly was written from the American point of view." And I thought, bingo, I've definitely got a theme here that us, we Americans, look at the band and look at the figure of Lennon in with a slightly different lens than the Britons do. And the Britons, they feel very proprietary about the story,
mm-hmm.
and they do kind of feel like Americans shouldn't be writing about it because we make so many mistakes, which we do. But we don't there's an essential Britishness to the story that we always seem to gloss over. And that's part of what they hold dear about it. So the other book that came out as I'm working on it is Philip Norman's biography.
Right.
Of Lennon. So I had contracted before those books, and I work a lot slower than those guys. So it kind of looked like I came out a little behind the curve. It was very interesting to read Philip Norman's book while I'm working on my book. But I did change a lot because he got to certain, he covered a certain amount of ground that I decided, okay, well, I'm going to emphasize other things and, fill in other gaps and stuff. And again, I felt like he was, I wanted to write a musical biography. One of my goals for the Lennon book was I wanted to write a history of rock and roll through Lennon's ears. Because that was another major theme, was that, just the way we look at this guy differently. The Brits actually heard rock and roll differently than we did as Americans. And they got it kind of as an export, as a kind of exotic export. And so different figures assumed different importance over there. And I was really fascinated by that process of cultural translation, and how people like Buddy Holly and Eddie Cochran, have real godlike status over there in Britain. I think it's Andrew Luke Oldham, the Rolling Stones manager, who writes about how Eddie Cochran spilled his blood on British soil,
Oh, wow.
and you realize, they think about Eddie Cochran like really, they rank him much higher than in our American mythology, right? And so I actually dove into Buddy Holly more and Eddie Cochran more, and I sort of tried to saturate myself in those figures. And even Gene Vincent, and McCartney talks a lot about Gene Vincent.
Mm-hmm.
And, Bebopaloo was... Lennon can barely articulate his excitement for that record. And it's a very unusual early rock and roll record. And it's not often listed in Americans' like top five great rock and roll records from the 50s. So I don't know. I just felt like there was a lot of new ground to cover. And it was a different take on a biography that I wanted to do. And I wanted to write an American biography that would somehow serve as a correction to the Albert Goldman monstrosity.
Yes.
That was the, so I had to, I started by reading the Goldman book again and, trying to sort my way through what was, it just was like more horrible than ever. It was just this crazy. I mean, he's crazy. The man is crazy.
Yeah.
The self-loathing that comes off those pages is really, oh. almost feel sorry for the guy.
Except he made money off it, of course, right?
Well, and yeah, and it, because of his, you know, I mean, it's like Trumpian, and it's just complete degeneracy,
the trashiness.
You know, his musical comments are really just woefully misbegotten. Just really way off the mark. So you're not going to learn much about the music from this big biography. I wanted to have a book that would be, you know, comprehensive. If you read one book about Lennon, this could serve as your one book. And also I wanted it to be, here's how we get from Gene Vincent and Buddy Holly to Strawberry Fields Forever. And I'll tell you, I knew I had a book when I had a conversation with Walt Everett, my co-author on the textbook. And I said, do you realize when Lennon wrote Strawberry Fields Forever? And he paused for a minute and he said, no, actually, I don't think I can figure that out. When did he write Strawberry Fields? And it was in Spain in the fall of 1966. And it's right before he meets Yoko Ono. And he's very nervous about it. He's very insecure about this new song that rolls out of him. And I knew when I had that conversation that this there's definitely a need for a book here, because nobody seems to like correlate like these incidents in Lennon's life and the songs that are happening to him as he goes along.
Huh. And that's something very interesting that we talk about a lot on our podcast when we discuss John. And I'm curious your thoughts about it, that, you know, we hear him tell stories a lot in the interviews and Jan Wenner and the Playboy interviews. How seriously, do you take what John says about his own work? And I know he talks about Strawberry Fields, and how seriously do you take it? Because we always feel he's just contradicting himself all the time, and just very impulsive with what he's feeling at the time.
Yes, it's very impulsive. It's very colorful. It's kind of this wild-eyed.
Yeah.
You know, he's like a splatter painting with skin, and it's just in the most wonderful way. And, you know, it's just kind of disorienting as a fan to sort of read the author of all this great work, and he can't figure out which song is from Revolver and which song, where was that on the White Album, you know? And you just kind of think, wow, we've got it all so clearly demarcated. But again, it's a barometer of how kind of messy and chaotic the times were, and how heavily sedated or, you know, have a heavily drugged he was a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And also that as a creator, his view of his material is not always on the level of empiricism, which is where the musicologists like to dwell, right? What is a fact here? And that's not really necessarily where creators should be dwelling. I told my Emerson students last week, I don't think artists are often the best people to remark on their own material. And they thought, wow, that's really radical. Like, who says that?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you have to understand Lennon's comments on this stuff as one piece of the story. It's not the definitive version of the story. And that's why, you know, the anthology gets you only so far. It's them telling the story from inside the bubble. And they get a lot of stuff wrong, and they don't care that it's wrong.
No.
But that's not their mission. That's not, you know, that, I mean, they shouldn't care. Why should they care?
Yeah.
You know, so I got the date wrong. Who cares? I was there. Right.
Right. Right.
And I think our attitude should be great. Fine. So you get your book and we'll do our books.
Yeah. Which leads us very nicely into this new book you just mentioned. So the textbook, and of course, now thinking about you also as I think of Walter Everett, of course, as a big influential music theorist, somebody in my field who's really a pioneer for analyzing the Beatles music in that way. Now you also, with your musical background, you bring a different spark to it as well, in addition to your being a critic and professor, journalist, all that stuff. So what was the, first ask, do you teach Beatles classes now at Emerson?
Yeah.
You do.
So at Emerson, I teach journalism, and it's a lot of digital journalism. It's a lot of daily journalism and beat journalism. But I have developed these specialized courses for the upper levels, and one of them is cultural criticism, where I teach a range of different kinds of platforms, so theater, television, movie, music, books, and how different critics think differently about the material they approach. And then I do, in the spring, I teach a course called Music Criticism, which is roughly a sort of a history of classic rock and a history of rock criticism, pop criticism, because a lot of students want to write about music.
Yep.
And you get a lot of good writing out of them if you set them free and writing about stuff that they're passionate about. But my idea is that I want to give them some context to the overall story. And a lot of them really just have shards of the story, or they, you know, they have a version that's, there's a lot of inaccuracies, or they have like one Beatle album and they don't understand where it fits. So it's a going through the larger rock mythology. And my thesis, which is polemical, and it's meant to be polemical, that is, I hope people argue with it, but my thesis is that we still live in the rock era, and that we still, that musicians are still working in the world that the Beatles created.
Hmm.
And that we haven't been through another rock and roll revolution that was anywhere near as big as what the Beatles lived through or then recreated for themselves. And I'm fully aware that there's an argument to be had there about that. But if you understand that framework, then you understand so much of what's going on in pop and rock and roll today. And you understand how people like Beck make records totally in the style of George Martin and the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole philosophy, that whole mythology is still very much with us. And it's also sort of like teaching the Godfather movies. You understand a central focal point of the history of movie making and how we arrive at that in the early 70s, and we still, those movies still hold up and they're still worth teaching, and that you're going to understand a lot about the way people make movies today in a new context if you understand how those movies are made.
So rock music is not totally dead then, even though it doesn't seem to have the same, well, maybe I shouldn't say that. I mean, the Beatles, they keep reinventing themselves in a lot of ways, but you still feel, even with the diffuse nature of music, popular music today, where anybody can just publish something on YouTube or do anything, that there's still a rock ethos around it?
I do, but I'm very quick to admit that I'm an older person, and that there's plenty of room for argument. I mean, you could very successfully argue that we live in the rap era.
Mm-hmm.
Rap has overtaken rock in terms of its influence, in terms of being a dominant style. But I would say that sort of rock and rap are sort of duking it out still together. And that, you know, when Kanye collaborates with Paul McCartney, or when Jay-Z covers Otis Redding, you know, that to me is evidence that they still think of the larger rock and roll mythology as something that's vital to the rap mythology. So you can't even understand rap mythology until you understand rock mythology.
Right.
So even if you disagree with the frame, you still need to understand what the frame is.
Mm-hmm. Well, and hopefully this book will help do some of that for students. So how did you come up with the idea to work on a Beatles textbook? Because as far as I know, it's the only one. Because
when
I've taught Beatles classes, I just cobble together stuff from all over the place, and so it's nice to have this approach. But what was the approach, and how did you decide, you and Walt decide to write it?
Well, so Oxford came to us, and Walt and I were friendly, and I was casting about. I didn't really know whether I wanted to write another book on the band or whatever, but I had a chat with Walt, and he said, well, you know, maybe we should do this together, because, you know, I bring a certain set of skills and you bring a certain set of skills. And I was very attracted to the idea of a co-authorship, because I had just been 8 years alone with this subject, and I really didn't want to do another book alone. That was a big incentive. You know, the other thing was, I was teaching and I was starting to get a bead on how challenging it was to sort of introduce this material to people who, you know, were born 20, 30 years after Lennon dies.
Right.
That's pretty, well, at least 20 years. Now we're going on 20 years after he died. So my students now are born 1999, 2000, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, you know, that's just a very curious, there's never a moment in a class when I'm teaching Beatles that I'm not surprised at some idea that they have or some you know, some piece of information that has been handed down. It's very curious to me what sticks, what doesn't, what songs they come in knowing and not knowing. Mm-hmm. And you know, we're starting to see the history fade a little bit. And so they don't have the same experience of the band that I do. And how do you introduce them to this without coming off like an old fuddy-duddy? And, you know, I mean, for a lot of them, it's dad rock. It's like, oh, yeah. Please, you know, enough with this stuff. And the noise around it is still very like, oh, God, like that's so 50 years ago. And, you know, it is.
Yeah.
But again, you have to sort of, you know, from a music historical point of view, if you're not dealing with the Beatle catalog, if you don't sort of come to terms with the Beatle catalog as a musician or as a critic or whatever you are, then you're not really dealing with what, you know, this huge influence that's out there. If you're going to be a jazz musician, you better learn Ellington. You better learn Charlie Parker. You better learn Satchmo. There's just some pillars that you have to deal with. You can't pretend they're not there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I teach it, is, you know, it's take it or leave it. You know, and my goal is not to get you to love the Beatles, although it, you know, it's kind of hard to like actively dislike the Beatles after you listen to them. But, you know, the point is not to turn you into Beatle fans. The point is to show you this enormous, enormous accomplishment of a catalog and how short a time span it occurs in and how much aesthetic development takes place in 7 years and how people still use Beatle recordings in their A-B's comparisons at the end of a session to make sure that the mix sounds as good as it possibly can, because those Beatle recordings still are like the gold standard for recording studios worldwide.
Very true. And I could imagine that it would be difficult to decide what to include and what to leave out, because you, every time you think, oh, well, I think we've covered Revolver, and you think, oh, no, I should be fun to talk about this or that, or what about Taxman, or what about the Love You Too, or whatever. So how did you two decide the approach? Well, or maybe you can just give an overview of the approach of the book, because I'm looking at the table of contents now, and you have kind of more historical things or context, like John Lennon discovers rock and roll or the Quarrymen, but then you also have lots of songs that have their own little section too. So how was it organized?
So of course we wanted to give a large overview that would give like the whole story in one book. But since I'd already done song by song and album by album with Tell Me Why, and Walt has a really wonderful 2-volume Schenkerian analysis of the whole catalog. Yeah. We didn't want to dig that deep. We didn't want to repeat ourselves. So we wanted to do like, there's an introduction for newcomers. And here's each chapter is going to have contained music roughly from 1 year of the career. And then we're going to do a bunch of deep dives into different songs to sort of demonstrate how thick you can get if you're into musicology and criticism. And here's some of the more notable songs and what some of the mechanics in these songs means. And we try and take advantage of a lot of the new scholarship that's happened since we both wrote those books. And so it's done like that. And I think there are 30 of these deep dive song essays. And we divvied those up and worked on those and collaborated together on those. And Walt brought a lot of musicology to the narrative. And I brought more like cultural context and historical events and, you know, how the Beatles really were world historical figures and were in a lot of ways having a conversation with their audience throughout the career as they went along, and what that conversation was about, you know. And it was about how people were thinking and behaving, and they were great catalysts for new ways of thinking and behaving, and you know to understand the context of what they were rebelling against. And then I also worked on these listening guides, which are visual videos that you can play that are will show you lots of details that happen in the music over 5 different layers as the music goes by. So there's a sort of a cursor in the middle, and you can watch as this lyric goes by. You can see this detail happens in the drums, and this detail happens in the production, and those listening guides I spent a lot of time on and worked very hard on. And they're meant to introduce people who are not maybe accustomed to it, to this just idea of close listening, deep listening, that you actually dive in and you listen to as much detail as you possibly can, and you understand how there's many different layers alive in the music at any given point.
Is that material on the website that goes with it?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
So it's linked off the Oxford website. I actually host it on my author website, which is timrileyauthor.com.
Okay, great. So I see the book still has some, I'm trying to think of the audience, because there's a lot of what you described is very accessible to a general non-musically, a student who doesn't have a lot of musical background, but there's still a lot of the waltz side. I'm looking through some of the song descriptions and song Roman numerals and harmonic things and a lot of that. So how did you target the audience? Since you'll probably get students on both sides.
Right. Our audience, we were very self-conscious about this. We wanted our audience to be a general readership. We wanted it to be for people who had never taken a music class before. Mm-hmm. But Walt has taught this material for a long, long time at University of Michigan. And so he kind of feels confident introducing musical terms and musical symbology to the general reader. And I trusted him for how far he wanted to go with that, because he's the theoretician.
Yeah.
But we also wanted to have a certain amount of depth to it, so that you would understand as a student, at least the first time around, if you'd never been exposed to any musical terminology, that musicologists have a language that we speak through, and we have a way of describing sounds and giving harmonies, symbols, and things like that, and that it would be readable even if you didn't understand the symbols, and it would be a text that either a musicologist could use or a political scientist could use.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to have it be sort of adaptable to many, many different contexts. And as we know, the Beatles sort of do fit into a number of different academic disciplines. So I teach it as a journalist, right? So I'm teaching journalism majors.
Mm-hmm.
And Walt teaches a lot of music majors, but we know there's other people out there who teach it from an English department, or some people might teach it from a history department, the history of the 60s. Some people might teach it from a political science perspective. And we wanted teachers to be able to say, oh, I want to use this text, but I'm going to use just this piece of the text. I may not use too much musicology in my course, but then maybe next year when I teach it, you know, at the Manus College of Music in New York, maybe I'll use more musicology. So we want it to be adaptable for a number of different disciplines and audiences, but primarily for that general listener, the untrained musician, the general reader who had never taken a music course before. And we worked very hard to make that language compress that language into its own paragraphs or its own sections.
Mm-hmm.
So that you would have a reading experience where you could go all the way through the book and we didn't want to intimidate people or condescend to people or speak down to the non-musician, but really just kind of say, you know, this is how musicians think, this is how musicians hear this music. And if you get a handle on that in that way, I think it can go a long way towards, you know, demystifying all of that stuff. A lot of which is, you know, like any other kind of new language, it's at first it looks kind of foreign and alien and it's kind of scary. But if you just kind of just plow through and say, all right, I'm going to skip all the parts I don't know, I don't understand what he's talking about with this funny zero sign right in front of the Roman numeral 7,
mm-hmm.
then you can actually just, you know, you can still get a 90% of what the whole thing is about.
Sure. And I think that's great, because I know Walt for a long time had trouble when he was back in, you know, starting to write about the Beatles, of making people take the music seriously from a scholarly
yes.
standpoint. And for you guys to do this and convey that to students, that there is actually a huge body of scholarship by really good musicians and scholars.
Yes.
I think that's really a great message to send.
Well, we both have fought this fight for a long, long time.
Yeah.
So we were both very used to the pushback of, oh, this is too much musicology. Oh,
right.
This is, you know, you're going over the heads. And you know, we said, look, we're teaching this stuff. We teach it every year. We know what the students can take. And we also felt very strongly that it's up to the teacher to figure out exactly how much of the book they want to use. You know, there's very few textbooks that I use 100%.
Oh, no, exactly.
You know, it's crazy. I mean, so we decided we were up for that fight. And, you know, we both sort of built, every time each of us had written a book on the Beatles, everyone had said at every step of the way, why do we need another book on the Beatles?
You
know?
Right.
So we were used to it.
Well, I'm curious. I'm looking at the your song analyses and things through the book. And since Abbey Road has been on the mind, and so you said Abbey Road was your first album that you'd gotten. I'm looking at the choices here. You spend a few pages on Abbey Road, and then the song that's chosen is Oh Darling, which is kind of an interesting choice. I would have thought, they'd probably pick something or the medley or something. So how did you choose for an album like that, which is so iconic with the medley, for example?
Well, I think because Walt really went to town on side two in the medley. I mean, that's a very his voice is very dominant there, and I know he had a bunch of ideas he wanted to really bring to bear on that material.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget how we chose it. I know I did a listening guide on I Want You.
Yes.
So there's that. But Oh Darling just seemed like a very, again, for the general reader, for somebody who's not really interested in a lot of thick musicology, it's a very, very telling example of how the Beatles take a genre exercise and turn it into something very Beatlesque, and then really just walk this tightrope of, so how much of this is sincere and how much is just parody? And I've always thought Oh Darling was a real interesting platform for that, because it's a vocal, it's a vehicle for Paul McCartney's voice,
mm-hmm.
and it's also sort of a, you know, their idea of a raunchy old 50s R&B number, and yet it's something quite different than that too at the same time. So it was a good opportunity to talk about a lot of different conceptual issues that I think they're dealing with in that song in a very fun, accessible way.
Well, that makes a lot of sense when you put it that way. There's already been books written on just the medley or just some of the...
Right.
Yeah, so right. It's good to delve into a different way.
All through this book, we're trying to do the non-obvious take, right?
Yeah.
There's so many takes, right? And we really did want to say, well, you know, here's an issue that we may not have talked about anywhere else in the book, but... it's too easy to glide over this number, and we have a conceptual idea here that's pretty fun to think about. So let's pull this out and blow this up and talk about, you know, so what are we talking, when we talk about genre parody, what are we talking about? And how do they make this whole idea of a genre parody so fun and interesting and distinctive, right?
Yes.
It's not, nobody else is gonna do a number like that. It's very Beatlesque. I'm intrigued by the idea that Lennon wanted to sing that song. I wish
we had that.
Takes of Lennon. I wish so bad. I think that's really the idea. Oh, what a great idea that Lennon should sing that song.
So I'm curious, as we kind of wrap up here a little bit, what do you think is this because you're feeling an area that had not been written about with the Beatles. There's not a textbook. Now there is. What do you feel, if there are any areas that are still untouched in Beatles scholarship that interest you particularly?
I'm looking forward to these Peter Jackson movies quite a bit this year.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because of this lifelong romance I've had with that material, with that film, Let It Be, but also he's going to do a documentary about January of 69. And the headline coming out of Apple is that they're going to put the final nail in the coffin, that this was a band in disarray and the tensions were high. So there's going to be a lot of good humorous stuff in there. Now, I think really the most interesting angle is that it was a band in great disarray that also was having a great deal of fun together.
Yeah, yeah.
The idea that you can't have both at the same time really doesn't... For me, the meat is right there. It's that they were on their last legs, and they knew that, and they had to go through those very difficult sessions in January 69 to persuade themselves that they wanted to do a final album and do it differently. and to go back that summer and make Abbey Road. Basically, what just sort of giving up, Let It Be, like they all had just walked away from it. It was like they were not going to issue that stuff. So, and I'm also very, very curious about the Let It Be, the stuff that's going to come out around those Let It Be sessions, because they're constantly, in all the bootlegs we have, they're constantly spilling all of this other material, all this material they grew up with and older material.
Yep.
And I've always felt like there's a PhD here in kind of mapping the Beatles' collective unconscious, which is here's the stew of all of the music they heard on the radio and on their record players growing up, and it's still with them. They carry it, you know, they're still so attuned musically to all of their sources, and some of them are predictable, and you know, there's a direct line and they launch into, you know, get out in that kitchen and rattle those pots and pans. But there's also a distinctively British history that has a whole bunch of obscure stuff that, you know, is like anybody's listening history, that you find records in your parents' collection that are just odd and out of the way, and you soak them up when you're a kid, and that turns into an influence. Mm-hmm. And all of those stray obscure things I have always found fascinating, and I've always thought there's more to do there in that particular history, because that's the one place where we have the Beatles on tape for large stretches of time, and they're busy just singing all these little ditties and one ditty reminds them of another, and
yeah.
they're almost like conversing through melodies. And I've often wanted a really great British musicologist to sort of harness that material and help make sense of it for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see that as a very rich ground still for people to do work in. I also think the other area for work is, when I teach my music criticism class, I spend the first half on the Beatles, Dylan, and the Stones. And I have often thought that there is a story to write about how they're are just these really interesting currents of influence that flow between these three major acts that haven't been fully examined yet. The idea that we all know that they're influencing one another, but it's very seldomly overt. And the references they make, the direct references they make to one another are very, very, very rare. And the idea that they were such titanic originals all at the same time, and that, you know, they were clearly listening and sponging up each other's records, but they still remained, you know, extravagantly unique and distinctive. And I think that's always been a fascinating subject to me, that, you know, I would really, if I could just have a chart of all of their listening habits, I would just be fascinated.
It would be fascinating.
You know, to sort of hear. Because we know that, say, that when the Beatles are in Paris, before they get to America, they're in Paris and they're busy sponging up Bob Dylan's Freewheel. And that's apparently a big record in the hotel room there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just think that Freewheeling has this enormous effect on how they write songs and the Hard Day's Night soundtrack. But nobody's ever written, okay, you know, here's sort of some of the connections. Now, those connections may not be overt, but there's definitely kind of a map that you could draw that would be really fascinating, I think.
Well, that sounds like a great future project. Are you working on, or tell us what you're working on right now, or anything going on?
I have decided that I don't want to write about white guys anymore. I'm putting together an anthology of critical things that I've written. I wrote a bunch for the Phoenix a long time ago, and I've written a bunch of book reviews more recently, and I'm just packaging all those things together, and I'm putting that together as an ebook. And then I'm going to look for a new project, but I don't know, it might be rock and roll, it might be classical. I've actually been listening and playing classical all the way through, and I really would like to write more about classical.
Good.
I haven't picked the next subject, but I feel a tremendous sense of freedom now that I'm teaching, I get to kind of choose whatever I want.
Yeah, it's the best job in the world.
Yeah, the best, the dream job.
Yes, absolutely. Well, so tell us, what is your website or best way to check out your work?
Yeah, so I I keep an author website at timreillyauthor.com, and I also run something called the Riley Rock Index on that site, and that is really a reference site or a link farm for music critics. So I have a bunch of links to all the major music critics who I follow and read all the time, and all the major reference sites that I use all the time, and that's called the Riley Rock Index. Mm-hmm. And I update that part every month at least. And then I write book reviews for Truthdig and for the LA Review of Books. So that's how you can find me. And I'm also very active on Twitter and on Instagram at Riley Rock Index.
Great. Well, this has been a real pleasure speaking with you, Tim Riley. And the new book is What Goes On, The Beatles, Their Music, and Their Time, the textbook co-written with Walt Everett. And just as I say, a real pleasure to speak with you, and we look forward to following what you're up to next.
Hey, I had a blast. Great questions. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks for speaking with me.